Hey, welcome to this week's edition of the Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I am joined by Mr. Terry Pluto. And Terry, I know people are saying, boy, Barry White is hosting this week's podcast with the way my voice sounds. But I've been battling something all week. Please bear with me. Terry, you had a great event last night at the Music Box. Sounds like you had a huge turnout.
Yeah, they basically sold it out. It was a lot of fun with including a couple guys who said they just kick your butt playing poker. So I'm just reporting what I said. You can't kill the messenger. And I found out things about you I had no idea. So
a couple of my friends went down to the thing. I'm going to have to find out who that was and who was giving you inside intel.
But so. I just want to thank everybody for coming, and it was a lot of fun. And there were a lot of different questions ranging from the Guardians' new manager to, of course, Deshaun Watson. One lady just yelled out OBJ. I wasn't quite sure how to respond to that. So I just mentioned that basically he had 35 catches. He made about $17 million a year. So it's almost $500,000 a catch.
Yeah, that's about it. He's just a guy now, pretty much. He's just a guy.
Yeah, he really is. So, but it was a lot of fun. Of course, you know, Browns talk, and by far the most of the things that people were wearing were Browns stuff. It's interesting to me, though. Most of the time when I go out and speak, not too many Cavs questions at all. I mean, our Cavs get nice numbers on the internet, and they sell out the games. But I guess there's just something about it. The Browns just dominate, you know, talk with everything.
Yeah, I think part of it is that the Cavs are kind of, and we talked about this last week, they're a little hamstrung in terms of moves they can make here at the trade deadline. And it's kind of that lull between now and the playoffs. It's kind of like they're just making the drive for the playoffs. Maybe things will pick up. So, but yeah, Terry, we got some great listeners. We put up our survey last week. And you can find that at tinyurl.com/TerrySurvey24. We had a bad link when we started, and one of our listeners actually alerted me to that, and I was able to fix it. But we've had many, many, many people go in there. We just want to know what you think of the podcast, the length, what we talk about, ideas you might have. There's a section there where you can just say whatever you want. So check that out. Again, it's tinyurl.com/TerrySurvey24. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate all of you going in there. We've had some really interesting responses, and I think we'll pull some of those out next week, right, Terry, and get into some of the ideas. So
sounds good to me.
All right. Hey, so we're going to start with the Browns today. We're going to get into the Cavs after the break. I want to ask you about Isaac Okoro and whether he's turning into the player the Cavs hoped he'd be when they took him. And then I want to get your thoughts on Carlos Carrasco. We also have a couple of letters from our listeners about where they're from, why they're Cleveland sports fans. We're still working through those. We're getting near the end, but let's start with the Browns, Terry. The big story of the week was the hiring of Ken Dorsey as offensive coordinator. And I know that you did a lot of making phone calls and checking with your sources to find out what was behind this. Why don't you give everybody a quick recap of what went down and why it went down, I guess, more importantly.
Of course, the Browns will always just say, we want to make the offense better in general, all this stuff. But it's Deshaun Watson driven. It's a decide, how can we get the most out of Watson? And that has been the discussion point from the moment they made the trade for him. Dorsey did very well with Cam Newton as a quarterback coach, and they liked the work he did with Josh Allen in Buffalo. I think that it's possible he could end up calling plays, but that's really not what this is about. It's about getting him in that shotgun offense and just trying to get him to be a little more consistent. And I want to ask you this. I'm just going to go there right away. I was with Watson, it's just so easy for me to go negative. This is confession time. I didn't like it before it happened. I didn't like it after it happened. And I haven't liked most of what I've seen. Now, I will give Watson credit for this. Since he's come over here, there's been no bad stories about off-the-field stuff or anything like that. You know, so that part's good. But I saw that podcast he did and read the comments that he doesn't like scripted plays. And I'm going to defer to you to open this. Because you are more of a football guy than I am. What did you make of that?
Well, the big thing with scripted plays, Terry, it's kind of like when you bring one of your kids on a college visit, and sometimes it's as important to learn what you don't like as what you do like when you're looking for a college. And I think a scripted play set, and you know, the 49ers and Bill Walsh and Joe Montana and those guys were the first ones, I think, to really do this, where they would script the first 15 or 20 plays back in the day. But part of it is not only to find out what works, but also what you're going to, what looks you're going to get when you put a certain formation on the field and you're running a certain thing. Well, are they going to do this? They're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And then you come back to something later in the game. So I appreciate that Deshaun Watson wants some freedom and be able to move on the outside and use his skills to get the ball to his playmakers. But I think there's value in a scripted play set, maybe not 20, but at least 10 or 12 plays to just see what the defense is running and what you're going to get when you put certain formations on the field. So I guess they can both be right in the situation. I think they do need to give him some more freedom, maybe changing plays at the line, but I think they can both be right here.
I'll have to check, but I know in the past with Stefanski and coaches before that, quarterbacks usually had an option to at least switch into another play. And I doubt that he is sending Watson to the line, because I've seen times when it was very clear Watson was changing the play. You know, you've watched that. So it's not like my wife Roberta has these, she has just these nice sayings. You're watching the goal line. Okay, it's, you know, it's fourth and two, the goal line. And everybody's piled in the middle of the line. And they run somebody right into the middle of the line, and he gets smashed. And she will say, why are they running where everybody's standing? And there's some wisdom to that. I mean, as opposed to, you can say, well, there's blocking schemes, blah, blah, blah. But I think you are allowed at the line of scrimmage, you don't have to just run where everybody's standing. You can have an option to switch to. So we'll see. Of course, then the numbers of like Flacco on that first drive, Mary Kay had that, I believe. Wasn't he like 4 out of 5 on the scoring a touchdown on the first drive? And I think Watson was 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6. So you could say, well, Flacco's a more structured quarterback and that kind of stuff. Or maybe Flacco flitched into the better play.
Well, and we saw both work for the Browns this season. I mean, in that Baltimore game when the Browns beat the Ravens, Deshaun Watson was just basically in the fourth quarter playing sandlot backyard football. Yep. Like, he was just making things happen. It was like watching Donovan Mitchell like close out a game, basically. Mm-hmm. That was what Deshaun Watson did, and I get that he wants some of that in the offense before it's crunch time. But I also get that the coaches have a job to do, and they have to look for tendencies in the defense and what can work. So I think if you're a Browns fan, you have to hope that this can work, that they can come to a solution here. And Watson wasn't like, I hate scripted plays, I never want to do them. Yeah. But it was a preference more than like him putting his foot down. So I think there's some middle ground here that I think they could kind of find.
Let's hope so. And then the other thing, then you flip back to Dorsey, and they'll talk about how to run the quarterback without getting the quarterback killed. That's going to be a big discussion point, because see, the thing about Josh Allen, he comes across as almost indestructible, you know, how big he is physically. I do not want Deshaun running as much as Josh Allen is, and certainly running into where everybody's standing, as Allen sometimes does. And I'm trying to remember Cam Newton. I don't recall him getting a ton of injuries from running the ball. But he was a bigger guy too, isn't he, than
He was. I mean, and he was just built thicker. He and Josh Allen are both just thicker guys than Deshaun. And they don't have Deshaun Watson's injury history, let's face it.
Sure.
I mean, and you've had shoulder things, Terry, over the years. And you know, once you hurt your shoulder, it's always kind of suspect. And I think you're right, Terry. The Browns would be right to have him run out of bounds, not be sticking his head into piles. If Josh Allen wants to stick his head into a pile and try and get an extra yard or two, go for it. But the Browns have too much at stake here with Deshaun Watson for him to be doing that. They just have to find another way. I agree.
Mahomes stays out of that. Russell Wilson for years, not very big at all, stayed away from the contact, yet was able to use his legs. Along those lines, the shoulder thing, and I wrote a column about this for Sunday, and I'm more adamant than ever. This is when you really have to spend on your backup quarterback. And I thought it was a bit strange that Andrew Berry sort of dodged that question, the backup quarterback question, by looking into the rearview mirror and saying, well, my first 2 years here, we had Case Keenum, of course, my favorite backup, at $6 million a year. And then the third year, they had Jacoby Brissett, $5 million a year. I loved all those signings. These are real quarterbacks. This past year, he said, well, we still put assets into it when you kind of add it all up. No, I added it all up. You don't. You gave $2 million to Josh Dobbs and whatever the rookie contract was for DTR, $750 or something. Less than $3 million. So that is not $5 million. It's not $6 million. And on top of it, none of those guys, neither guy, DTR or Dobbs, had the resume or the experience of a Keenum or a Jacoby Brissett. So they need to flip back to that. And as you mentioned, a shoulder injury to me is very concerning. I'm not claiming to be a doctor or whatever, but I do know that in baseball, they much prefer a guy to have an elbow injury than a shoulder injury. And they kept saying that the rotator cuff one wasn't the same as this one. So take your pick, whether one led to the other or he had two separate shoulder problems, it was still shoulder. So let's get a real backup in here. And if it costs $6 or $7 million, whether it's Flacco or Jacoby, or I even mentioned Gardner Minshew, go for it. Minshew signed for $3.5 million with the Colts. That was a bargain. You know, remember, we're not talking real world here, everybody. We're talking NFL. That's why I never write out like 3,500,000, because my head would fall off my shoulders. But so you put 3.5, because so it's sort of relative to that, because that, you know, that's just the storyline that applies. So anyway, those are my three guys. I'll take any one of the three.
Oh, okay. So I was going to get a little more into it. So how would you rank those three, Terry? If you had to pick one, who would you take?
I mean, how do you go away from Joe? I'm just thinking Joe's going to end up somewhere else.
I do too. And one of the reasons I'll tell you why, Irie Harris, our colleague, he goes down to the visiting locker room after every game. And after, this is just one reason that was a tip off to me, but he went down and was interviewing Garrett Wilson after the Browns won that game. And Garrett Wilson said he was really happy for Joe and that after last season, he wanted to go somewhere where he could play and start.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out for him, but now it might, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to think of all these teams that need quarterbacks. Just off the top of my head, like the Patriots.
Yeah, the Patriots.
The Raiders.
Washington.
Would the Broncos want him? The Steelers? Yeah. The Titans? Like the Commanders, like you said, like there are probably 5 to 8 teams that would love to have Joe Flacco on their roster. Maybe to start, yes, but also the Titans have Will Levis. It would be great to have Joe Flacco showing Will Levis how to be an NFL quarterback in his second season, right? Like, I don't see Flacco coming back here at all. I just don't.
You could try to sell Joe on the Sean shoulder problems, and then we could flip back to you, and you know you've had success. I mean, I would try to frame it that way. But now I'm Joe. Joe's agent is another Joe, a guy named Joe Linta. I'm going, well, that's very nice. But as you said, I could go, and I could compete with Will Levis. I just might be better than Sam Howell in Washington. You just all those things. So I would take Minshew, and then I would take Jacoby. And the only reason I would probably go more Minshew than Jacoby is he's a little more mobile. And if they're going to do this more out of the shotgun, everything else, that might fit better. But either one of those guys, I would love to see the Browns have them. And as you saw, I mean, Minshew was 7-6 with the Colts. He nearly carried them into the playoffs. Had they just played decent defense for Jacoby when they ranked 10th in scoring with Jacoby as the quarterback, they would have been 7-4 instead of 4-7. So,
and just for some background, Terry, Gardner Minshew, 28 years old, $3.5 million last season in 2023, as you mentioned, and Jacoby Brissett, 32 years old and $8 million. And they're both unrestricted free agents. So, but there's some other interesting guys out there, but I think those are two good choices.
I don't want to hear salary cap on quarterbacks anymore. You got to pay for a 1-year quarterback. You pay this guy. because I don't want to go through DT, and DTR could be number three. You develop number here, but it, if you're in the this is all in, we're not in the development right here. Heck, that's why we fire. I mean, really, what did Alex Van Pelt do to get fired?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you get down to it. I'm not saying he was basically, maybe you're saying, well, he's not great. And you're saying, well, we need to do something better to try and get with help with Deshaun. But it's not like there was any egregious conduct by Alex Van Pelt. And we actually saw periodically when he called plays, he, you know, he did a solid job. So they just changed to change. And I had a list a couple weeks ago in my column on John Harbaugh. I think it's six different offensive coordinators he's been through in his 15 years. So teams change these guys all the time. Two of those guys did go on to be head coaches, but the other four were fired.
Hey, Terry, I wanted to go back to talking about Watson for a second. I'm wondering if we're entering a new phase with Deshaun Watson here. And I got the sense sometimes watching games that he was trying to prove to his to Browns fans and maybe to a lesser extent his teammates that he was a, that he was tough and that he was all in to make up for being out so long. And that was why he was going so hard into piles and really trying to grind out extra yards on scrambles and putting himself at risk. And I wonder if just after everything that's happened, if everybody's like, listen, you've proven that to everybody that you're tough enough and that people are going to believe in you and you're starting to win fans back. And if it's going to be kind of a new era where that will happen, where he doesn't feel like he needs to prove the toughness thing anymore. Do you buy that? I just was thinking about this the other day.
Well, when is, if it doesn't happen now, when? See, because my thing on quarterbacks and kickers is you're a kicker, you're a quarterback, you're not a football player. I expect you to train like a football player, you know, all that. I don't want you tackling people. Remember, Baker Mayfield, how did he get hurt, David?
Chasing down an interception and making a tackle.
Yep, at least trying anyway. And by the way, what did he hurt?
Shoulder, right?
Yeah, even though it was his left shoulder, yeah. It messed him up. You don't see you're prone to that. And then Dustin Hopkins, part of the reason Hopkins has had problems in the past is hamstring injuries. Brother, you just jog down the field if that'll make you happy. You just don't we're not putting you at the starting block and firing it off. Because here's the problem. Even if Myles Garrett gets hurt in the game, you got some other defensive ends there you could put in. You're going to miss them, but you got somebody. Your kicker goes down. You saw what happens. De'Anthony Bell, well, I did kick in the eighth grade. Well, I'm glad to hear that, but I don't think that's exactly what we want to do for a 30-yard field goal. Or even the quarterback situation, especially when you don't have that Case Keenum, Jacoby Brissett, you know, Joe Flacco available. So don't run in the pile. Run out of bounds. Slide. Stop. I mean, if he was very stubborn about this, I would almost embarrass Deshaun and say, no, you know when you're letting people down? When you're doing this stuff and you're getting hurt. That's when you're letting people down. You're not letting people down, right, when you're
– you're right, Terry. If you were to ask Browns fans what they want to see from Deshaun Watson in 2024, it's for him to be on the field. And I think you should make a T-shirt like, don't be a football player, be a quarterback.
Be a quarterback.
I think that's a great
motto. I've always
motto.
Believed
yeah.
that. I remember when Vinny Testaverde, this is when they, right as they were planning actually to cut Bernie Kosar, they hadn't done it yet, but they were thinking about it real seriously. And Vinny was playing against the Steelers, and he went into a pile to run the ball. And Chip, can we say, you know, as my friends in my black church would say, everybody say shoulder injury, you know, shoulder injury again. I forgot what was a dislocated or what he did. And sure enough, then the next week, Bernie played. And that's when the whole thing blew up with Belichick. And that's when they cut Bernie and they played Todd Philcox. But you go back to what was happening there was Vinny was trying to prove he was a football player. That he got in for Bernie. He's going to make this work, all this stuff, and he got hurt. And especially whether you're carrying the ball and you're dropping your shoulder or you're throwing your shoulder in to tackle somebody, you earn your living with your shoulders, plural, as Baker showed us, you know, there. Don't mess with this.
All right, Terry, we're going to wrap up the segment here in a second, but I did want to get in this quick question from Eric Gangwer from Fremont, Ohio, and it's about the wide receivers. And Eric says, hey, guys, the fans are clamoring for a bona fide number two to pair with Amari Cooper at receiver. I don't see that happening. Is Amari going to even be on the roster next year with that contract and cap hit? I can see the team staying content with the receivers they have now and hoping for improvement out of Elijah Moore, David Bell, and Cedric Tillman. Will they make a splash for another receiver? What do you think, Terry?
They better make sure they have Amari. You can just rework that contract. Amari had 1,000 yards with all these different guys throwing to him.
He was their best he was their best offensive player, period.
Period. Yeah, good point. Yeah. Excellent point, David. I never thought about that in that context. You are absolutely right. Granted, he had a heel injury a little bit towards the end. But and on top of it, Amari called Flacco a faith multiplier, but you talk to the quarterbacks, they'll say, no, he's a faith multiplier, you know, because I have faith in him that he's going to run the right route. I can throw it up there. He's going to catch it. He's going to know everything the defensive backs are doing. He's going to be a star in the meetings in terms of his quiet confidence and leadership. This is like, you want to win this year? You find a way to pay Amari Cooper. You rework this thing.
Well, two things, Terry, real quick. Thanks for that question, Eric. I think you got us going on some good stuff here. But the NFL salary cap, it's like when people run up their credit card debt. Like, you can keep it going as long as you want, but eventually you're going to pay. And if the Browns want Amari Cooper on the team, they're going to find a way to keep him. And I'm pretty sure they're going to because, like we said, he's their best offensive player. But the other thing is this kind of reminds me of a hockey lineup a little bit. There's three sets of four forwards, right? Yeah. There's your top six and your bottom six. And usually your top six are the guys who can score and really have a lot of skill. And the bottom six are guys who like to bump and, you know, fight for pucks and everything. I think the Browns have a lot of second line. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a lot of bottom six guys right now who are playing top six roles. And they need to find – I think they do need to find a number two receiver. And I think they can find one in this draft in the middle rounds. But they've got to find someone to move into that number two spot. I know we've talked about David Njoku, but they need another weapon. Like, let's be honest.
Sure.
I think we saw that toward the end of the season. They need someone else they can put at the top of that lineup. And then the other guys can bump down. David Bell's he can be a fine possession receiver. I think Cedric Tillman, like his best days are ahead of him, right? Being a rookie and Ashley Bastock, our colleague, wrote a feature about it. It takes him a while to catch on, but once he does, he really gets it. So maybe year two will be a breakout for him. But like, you can't rely on that. You just can't. So I think we're going to see them make a move for somebody.
Usually there's a veteran out there that it comes March and just that deal, he doesn't get the deal he wants to get. And you could maybe that becomes the guy. Or there's
a
guy
out there.
Good
idea. I like that.
Or there's a guy out there that, like Amari Cooper, suddenly somebody thinks we just can't pay him. So you're putting a Pro Bowl guy basically out on waivers. You know, that was sort of in effect it was. And the Browns, I think, traded a fifth-round pick for Cooper because they were able to fit him in the salary cap. So you can say we can't fit everybody, but you have to decide really where you're going to allocate resources. And, I mean, backup quarterback, maybe not a superstar receiver, but a good receiver, a good veteran receiver, can help you. I think they were disappointed in Tillman, no matter what they may say. They thought they would get more out of him. And as we saw, too, he had a couple of games where he messed up the pattern and Flacco threw interceptions. You know, Flacco tried to cover for him. But I think even Stefanski mentioned, well, we could have, you know, run that better or something like that. And he really, really mentions those things.
Yeah, that's code for the receiver. The receiver messed it up. So
he was supposed to go right and he went left or whatever he did. So,
all right. Thanks for that question. If you want to hit us with a question or comment on the podcast, as always, hit us up at sports@cleveland.com on your email and just put Terry's talking in the subject line. We'll try to get it in. So, all right, Terry, let's take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you what you've been thinking about the Cavs, especially last night with Darius Garland returning. And I want to get into Isaac Okoro a little bit and whether you think he's becoming the player that the Cavs hoped he would be. So we'll get into that and more when we return on Terry's Talkin'. We're back on Terry's Talking, David Campbell and Terry Pluto. I think my voice is getting a little better the more I'm talking, so that's good. Hey, I need to do a quick plug here, Terry. We have a new podcast. If you like food and drink, and boy, who doesn't? There's a new podcast at cleveland.com. It's all about drinking and dining in Greater Cleveland. It's hosted by Josh Duke and Alex Darris from our newsroom. They have fun talk about the latest foodie happenings. They join Mark Bona, Paris Wolf, Peach Akarian. They did a segment last week, or a week and a half ago, about the galley boy from Swenson's, which I'm sure you've had, Terry. It's an Akron institution, right?
Yes, it is an Akron institution. And Swenson's also has, which I never would have tried, but my dear friend, Roberta Nigoria, Goria Williams, who sang for all those years, she would get the fried bologna sandwich there.
Oh, nice.
And you know, it was good. I was always like, yeah, not big. She'd get, try it. And I did. So I've had it twice. So how's that? They can talk galley boy. I'm talking fried bologna.
There you go. Yeah, they'll get into fried bologna and everything else. They do everything from Swenson's to some of the higher-end restaurants in Cleveland. The podcast is called Dine, Drink, CLE, and find it anywhere that you download podcasts. So check that out when you get a chance. So, all right, Terry, the Cavs have been feasting on teams here the last month or month plus, actually. They're 29-16, number 4 seed in the East. And I know you had your event last night, but you were able to catch a fair bit of the game last night against the Pistons. And it was the return of Darius Garland. Evan Mobley is back. How do you see these pieces fitting together here? And how do you think the return of Garland changes things, or maybe it doesn't? I don't know.
Oh, it changes it. Now, what I did like is a lot of the times Donovan was still bringing the ball to court. It was still in his hands, because this has been I've been advocating that from the moment Garland got hurt, that to make it his team, put the ball in his hands. And not that JV needs me to tell him what to do, but I'm glad he was thinking the same thing. And so I saw that, and I saw Garland doing some stuff off picks, but there still was a little bit of my turn, your turn, with the two guards. So we'll see how that plays out. Mobley, it was a little hard to tell, watching that with Allen and Mobley some, because Allen played and had his double-double, but he was sick. He wasn't feeling as good as normal, so I think his energy level. How about that? I'm saying the guy had a double-double, but his energy level didn't really match. But he's been just so dynamic on that, both boards and everything else. I want to see more. Then, of course, we saw Darius got hit in the face again at one point in that game. I mean, you kind of wonder how long is that? Because remember, a year ago, he kept getting hit in the face. And I forgot whether he had an eye thing or something. So this may be one of those where you do it the two, but one of these guys could get hurt. And
I wonder if they should go back to the mask for a little bit just to play it safe until fully.
Rip Hamilton did. Rip Hamilton for his whole career, because he was he was a slight guard, much like Darius. By the way, Darius should look at tapes of Rip Hamilton running off picks and creating his own shot that way. And then when needed, he could play point too. But my goodness, he was so good without the ball. And then I was very glad JB just put Merrill in there and gave him his minutes back. And what did he get? 13 points. And he's a nightmare to cover because of his size, along with the moving so well without the ball. Cutting real tight against those screens. You know, some of the comparisons have been to Kyle Korver. I actually think he moves better than Korver. Now, Korver is one of the all-time great shooters, you know, just straight out. But in terms of moving, this guy is faster than Korver, and he's about almost the same size. And you know, he keeps surprising you on showing more basketball skills. A couple times he backdoored, you know, made a layup. There was one play he backdoored to the guy covering him, and Donovan just threw a beautiful bounce pass right there for 2 points, cut into the basket. I mean, that stuff is really why I love basketball. So I liked all that. I want to see more. I don't have a big thought on Evan just yet. I think he's kind of – I know the numbers haven't been bad, but he seems to be easing his way back in. And I don't blame him. He had knee surgery 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, so Terry, you mentioned Sam Merrill. I wanted to ask you real quick. I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but who do you think has the top 3-point shooting percentages on the Cavs? If you were to guess who are the top 3 percentage leaders in 3-pointers. Sam Merrill is number one. I'll give you a
right.
hint.
I mean, he's at
43.3.
Yeah, I was going to say he's at 45% the last I look. Okay, number two, because Garland and Donovan are not shooting as well as you would think.
Correct.
And Strus has fallen off, really fallen off with that.
I was surprised when I saw this.
Yeah, Yang is moving up, but I don't think that. I think Okoro's in the second or third, because he's
great guess.
38% or something, isn't he?
He is number three, yes. Isaac Okoro is number three, and Dean Wade is in between them. So it's Sam Merrill at 43.3, Dean Wade at 39.9, and then Isaac Okoro at 37.5. So it got me thinking. I mean, he's in a contract year, Terry, and he's really going for it. And I know he's trying to get as many minutes and make as much of an impact as he can for this team, but he's also playing for himself in a lot of ways. I pulled his stats from this year: 36 games, 26 minutes per game, 9 points per game. He's shooting 49.6 from the field and 37.5 on threes, and he's averaging 0.9 steals per game. Last year, 76 games. 21.7 minutes per game. So he's gone from 21.7 to 26 minutes per game. His points per game has gone from 6.4 last season to 9.0 this season. His field goal percentage has gone from 49 to 49.6. And then his threes have gone from 36.3 to 37.5. And then his steals at 0.7 to 0.9. He's starting, it seems like, to become what they hoped he would be, which is like a 3-and-D guy who can give you great minutes and stop the other team's best perimeter players. I mean, I don't know. How do you see Isaac Okoro progressing this season? Am I making too strong of a case for him?
Okay, when you look at Okoro, I think he was the fifth pick in the draft. And there was a feeling, well, if you're fifth pick in the draft, you have to be an all-star or this type of thing. That thinking has changed just because these kids come out when they're so young, like Isaac did, many others. They're not ready. And basically, they were looking for a guy who could defend and hoping he would be a 3-and-D. And I don't think he's a classic 3-and-D guy, even though the percentages are pretty decent. But what has helped him offensively is the faster pace allows him to get out more on the break and score, and also just to drive to the rim a little more. He's a good player. I mean, not great, but he's a pretty good player. He fits in with this group more now because it isn't like everybody dwelling on, oh, he doesn't make enough threes or this. They got enough guys jacking him up. He could just, you know, he could fire a few from the corner. They need him more to get out there and defend people, because if you're going to really play this up and down style, they need more defense in the backcourt. Garland doesn't guard much of anybody. I mean, let's be honest. And Donovan is pretty good at getting steals, deflections, and that. His man-to-man defense is just fair. But if you need a guy, and a small forward, Strus is pretty good. Niang really is better at guarding power forwards. I'm just kind of going through it in my head. You know, Wade has a little bit of marketing in him in that he could defend a bigger guy and a smaller guy. Nonetheless, if you're facing a guy that goes for 25 or 30 points a game, Okoro's who you want to put on him for at least 20-some minutes a game.
I think you make a good point. Oh, sorry.
He's not an offensive waste anymore either.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking back to the Knicks series last year where the Cavs needed him to make threes. I think you made a great point. And like this year in the playoffs, they're not going to need him to make threes. I mean, if he makes some, that's great, and he'll make more than he did last year. But it's not like their series is going to hinge on whether he knocks down a three or not, because like you said, they have other guys doing that now. I think that's a really good point.
They didn't move at all. They were totally stagnant. You had one guard. The two guards were taking turns. Mobley was really overwhelmed. Jarrett was lost. They packed the middle of the court. There was no creativity in terms of how to get the guys the big men the ball. So it was a disaster. But my point is you can't just have that obliterate the team, whether looking backward or even looking forward. And I really feel better because I've been ever since we started a podcast, or really since I was around him just a little bit, I've been a big JB advocate. I think he's a really good coach. He's shown it again. And this will be a little tricky for him, because if you're Merrill or you're Okoro or you're one of these guys that was getting all these minutes while those players were hurt. And now suddenly it begins, like the first game Monday night, Merrill played 7 minutes. Talk about sitting there going, well, what did I do wrong? They're still trying to figure it out. That's going to be a little tricky for him, how to handle the minutes and who gets what, and then to keep those guys connected. But right now the Cavs so seldom have had a fully healthy roster that, you know, the old thing, it probably will work itself out. Nonetheless, I just could not be more pleased with where they're at and anxious to see where they're going with the two guys back.
Yeah, having a whole roster and making a push after the All-Star break for the playoffs, we'll be keeping track of that. They've got a – boy, this is one of the toughest things in sports, Terry. The home game followed by a road game the next night. You got to fly out after your home game. It's so much nicer to have the road home back-to-back. But the NBA's gotten rid of a lot of back-to-backs, and this is one of the tougher ones the Cavs will have. They're at Memphis tonight on Thursday night. We're taping this early Thursday afternoon. And then Saturday they are at San Antonio. Who are you putting on Wemby, Terry?
Oh,
that's Allen or Mobley?
I'm going to just throw them both. Take this guy, that guy. This is the perfect team to play Wemby. And more I watch Wemby. Now, we'll have to see, because the comparison is unfair because of the age difference. But he does remind me some of Ralph Sampson. Sampson played 4 years at Virginia when he came in. You know, Wemby played, 1 year in France? Was he 19 or whatever he is? So this would be like Sampson's sophomore year in high school, in college. But that's what he reminded me. And Sampson always, I believe he's in the Hall of Fame. And he won games, but he always was sort of a strange player with the different coaches trying to figure out how to exactly to maximize him. And so I want to see if Wemby goes. By the way, if the worst thing you become is Ralph Sampson and make the Hall of Fame, I think that's pretty good.
Not too shabby, but, yeah.
Yeah, but when they talk about a generational player changing the game, I'm not so sure about that. But I need to see a lot more.
Yeah. Well, it'll be a fun one on Saturday, something to keep an eye on. So, all right, Terry, let's move on to the Guardians. One thing to get into real quick here, a Cleveland fan favorite is back, Carlos Carrasco, who's now 36. The Guardians have signed him to a minor league deal. He will earn a base salary of $2 million if he makes the big league club, and another $2 million in performance bonuses if he makes it into the majors. What did you think of this move? And how do you see him? How would you see him fitting into the pitching staff, I guess?
I guess they'll know in spring training how healthy he is, because 21 and 23, he was just hurt all the time. ERA around 6, not very good. In 2022, I believe he won 15 games. Granted, he barely pitched 6 innings in some of those games, but a veteran pitcher getting through 6 innings, even 5 plus, will really help the staff. On top of it, you know, Carrasco isn't just a fan favorite. I mean, Carrasco's up, you'll say, about all the right stuff. You know, he kept wanting to sign extensions to stay here. He's a leukemia survivor. I mean, he's the kind of guy that could sit down with a younger player and say, you know, hey, bro, you better prize these moments. Because I could tell you, one day I was, you know, a borderline all-star, and I'm just not feeling good. And I thought it was the flu, and it was this, and they went in, they did the blood test, and I had leukemia, and it turned my life upside down. And I'm just not saying this can happen, but you just never know. And also, Carlos had overcome Tommy John surgery. So he could talk about what it takes, and here he is at 36. At least he's going to training camp with the team. And, I mean, you know the fans will just give him huge ovation. If he could just, you know, 3 runs in 5 innings, he'll get standing ovations every time he loses a mound, you know, because that's how Cleveland is.
I also wonder, Terry, like with this young starting rotation, I think you're right on the,
yeah,
it's the reason they brought back Austin Hedges too, is just they want guys around who get what the Guardians are supposed to be about. But I also think if you look at this offseason, it seems like the Guardians are trying to build a bridge between that starting rotation to Class A. And the bullpen and closing games out. And I think Carrasco might be able to fill a role where somebody gets shelled and is out in the third inning. He might be able to pitch 4, 5, 6, you know, kind of a bridge pitcher to get you those middle innings when you need somebody to eat some innings. I don't know. That's just an idea.
No, but. And he's done it before. When he was struggling several years ago, they put him in the bullpen, Tito did, and they rebuilt him because he was trying to throw too many pitches, and he had a bigger windup. He came out with a much more compact motion, throwing just a couple of pitches, and his career took off. So he understands that. See, that's what I meant in terms of what he could speak to. But for those words to have some real oomph to him, he's still got to be able to pitch reasonably well. So that would be a good thing. And Hedges, when I was at the Guardians thing, I mean, Stephen Kwan mentioned Hedges. And I'm trying to remember who else it was. Naylor mentioned Hedges. These guys mentioned Hedges. And I do know that Jose was thrilled that Hedges was coming back because he needed, as he said, what he didn't say publicly, but I heard he told us, some help running the clubhouse here. Yeah. And, you know, which is a thing there, a guy that is respected. And I believe they knew last year they could have used some more veterans around. They might have just, you know, they didn't have Hedges. They didn't have Luke Maley. They brought in Zunino, who they hoped would be the guy, but Zunino's whole game and was falling apart. And he was not the vocal leader of those other guys. And he didn't have the credibility those other guys did. So, it's a fun thing. I love when you make a move like that because it's basically there's zero risk and there's a possible really nice reward.
All right, Terry, the off season, the hot stove season is kind of a time when you can take a look at some bigger picture things. And Ken Nahegian from Virginia sent us a thing where he wanted to realign baseball, but we're going to get into that next week because I don't think my voice can take going through all of it, but we're going to try and get to that next week, Kent. I appreciate you sending that in. So, hey, quick reminder, if you want to hit us with any questions, comments, it's sports@cleveland.com is an email, and put your thoughts in there with Terry's talking on the subject line. Also, don't forget about Terry's book, The Guy with the Sign. You can find that at terrypluto.com. And also Terry's newsletter. Go to cleveland.com/newsletters and you can sign up for Terry's newsletter right there. It takes like 2 minutes. You just click a box and off you go. So, all right, Terry, we still have a few. I think we're coming down to the last 10 or 12 of these, but these are some letters from fans who are listeners of the podcast and wrote in with why they're a Cleveland sports fan and where they live. It was something you asked back when we were doing our 100th episode. So I guess we'll get in a couple of those before we wrap up here. You ready?
Okay.
All right. It's this one. It comes from, let's see here, I got to get my things straight here. Steven Esker from New York, New York. He's an Akron native. He says, "Hey, David and Terry, it's been a while since I last wrote, and I remain an avid weekly listener. I heard your request for Cleveland Area Connections and thought I'd share a few lines. I was born in Akron in the early 80s at St. Thomas Hospital, represent. And I moved to New York when I was in elementary school for my dad's job. Every year we'd return to Northeast Ohio where I'd spend the dog days of summer with my grandparents and cousins in Ohio, pretending I was a Cleveland Indian in the basement where my grandpa watched every game. For a few summers, I was Carlos Baerga hitting home runs from both sides of the plate or Steve Olin with his submarine pitching style. And I still remember his untimely passing due to the tragic boat accident, even though I was just a young kid. The 90s were a special time for a Cleveland Indian fan with those amazing teams. But with all the fun memories comes the lasting sting of sadness, knowing we were so incredibly close just to fall agonizingly short a few times. Being a kid growing up in New York, I was surrounded by exuberant Yankees fans who got to celebrate the joy of a World Series victory over and over and over and over. I still live in New York and remain as passionate about my Cleveland Guardians Indians as ever. The one thing that keeps me going is knowing that when the moment comes that we end our drought, we will have earned that moment together as a fan base." And again, that's from Steven Esker in New York, New York. So
ask those Yankee fans, who has last been to the World Series, the Yankees or Cleveland?
Man, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has.
All right, Terry, I think we're done here. Anything else? Any other appearances or anything coming up you want to mention?
Nothing right now. So,
all right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you for putting up with my voice this week. And we'll be back next week for another edition of Terry's Talkin'.